ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey there, Sana Qadar here from All in the Mind. Check out our new series, Forensic. It's all about the psychological tools and tricks that come with investigating crime.
He was setting the bombs off in subways, in the New York Public Library, in movie theaters.
When you're testifying in court, rather than having purely your own memory, you take on all these little bits and pieces of information from different sources.
All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, it's the music show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. Later on today's show, Cain and Abel are coming in together with their harpsichord player. We'll have them in the music show studio. Specifically, we'll have Ashley Timms and Madison Nonoa with Erin Helliard. They are all part of Pinchcut's production of The First Murder. It's a 1707 opera by Alessandro Scarlatti. But first, Jamie Stewart and Shushu have been among the leading figures in American avant-pop for a couple of decades now. That avant-pop is a sort of blend of dark subject matter and catchy pop. And so maybe it's not surprising that they're drawn to the work of David Lynch. They put out a version of the music for Twin Peaks, and now they're coming to Dark Mofo with their take on the music of Eraserhead. Their latest record, though, has some surprising influences. It's an album of covers ranging from Coil and Talking Heads, maybe that's not so surprising, through to Roy Orbison and this one, which is definitely surprising.
Please don't take my man. Jolene, 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 Jolene. Please don't take him just because you can. But I could never love again. He's the only one for me, Jolene. I had to have this talk with you. My happiness depends on you. And whatever you decide to do, Jolene. Jolene, 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 Jolene. I'm begging you, please don't take my man. Jolene, 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 Jolene. Please don't take him just because you can.
Well, that's Jolene, and it is from the latest album from Shushu, and it's a great pleasure to welcome to the music show Jamie Stewart. Jamie, hello.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Jolene, we have to talk about the choice of this song, and I maybe I could start by asking if you have any idea what Dolly thinks.
Oh, no. Which I think I would be, it's too much, it's too much pressure to even consider it.
So why that song?
Well, it's part, let me sort of put it into context. Like a lot of musicians during the pandemic, we were trying to look at, you know, other ways to spend our time, you know, other than going on tour, and other ways to supplement our income. So we started a subscription of different, and we would do a different cover song every month, along with a lot of other different music. But sort of the central aspect of it is, do we cover every month? And we've been doing this, I guess, at this point for about 5 years. But each of the songs that we do every month, it's always a song that has, in one way or another, as music fans, been important to us. And you know, I mean, Jolene is the original of the Dolly Parton version of Jolene is hands down a masterpiece. The singing is extraordinary. The lyrics are incredible. The playing is incredible. The original guitar intro. And actually the guitar player who played that just passed recently, sadly. But the fundamental reason for doing that song is that as a music fan, when you listen to it, it is undeniably moving.
Yeah, but it's also quite a strange song, isn't it? I mean, when you, the power...
Oh, it's incredibly strange, yeah.
You know, in the lyrics, the power dynamic is... There aren't many songs quite like that.
Not at all. I mean, the fact that she is essentially begging for her emotional salvation is not something that comes up in songs frequently. But Dolly Parton is, you know, as much as being... Most people know her for, you know, obviously her appearance is fairly iconic and extraordinary, and people know her as being a nice person. But she's a scholar of music from the region that she lives in, the region that she grew up in Appalachia. And the song is very, very similar to a lot of Scottish ballads, and you know, the subject matter, and that it's so bleak and so hopeless, and I don't want to say the word needy because it sounds like a criticism, but the person who is singing it is in such a state of dire need. And the music of Appalachia, the people who live there largely came from Scotland. So a lot of the original music that Dolly Parton is an expert in is based in that type of foundation and that type of, you know, kind of fundamental type of emotional distress. And it seems like, I mean, the lyrics don't seem to have precise parallels, but the feeling of that song seems like it could have come from that region and is very influenced by, you know, her expertise in musical history.
Yes, yes. And you're showing your roots here too, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. my father and my uncle were fairly famous folk musicians, so American folk music is close to my heart.
Yes, but you wouldn't necessarily pick that from listening to Shoo Shoo.
Well, no. I think it's circuitously there is a direct connection, but Shoo Shoo is essentially like an experimental art rock band with a lot of other tangential interest, so you wouldn't necessarily. It's that connection is not clear, but I think the clarity of that connection comes from a lot of the things that we discuss are discussed in similar ways that American folk music approaches this sort of travesty that is living insofar as we try to be direct. There's spiritual connections. You know, American folk music and most folk musics around the world don't shy away from how hard it is to be a person.
No, and it's not getting any easier. Let's maybe talk.
Sorry for laughing.
That's all right. No, sometimes that's all one can do. Let's talk about covering songs, because this is, you know, you've done Fast Car of Tracy Chapman, and there was an album of songs associated with Nina Simone, and I wonder how you choose them and whether you think, oh, this will work for us, because sometimes listening to them, I think this surely was a dare.
There's two main considerations. One I talked about a little bit before. It's a song that we're a fan of, or a song that in one way or another has been important to us as fans. Either we learn something from it as musicians ourselves, or, you know, in the way that anybody loves music and their heart is touched by music, it is touched our heart. So that's the most fundamental aspect of it. The other is can we even do it? I mean, a lot of songs I would like to do, I just don't have the technical aptitude. Like Prince is one of my all-time favorite musicians. There's no way in the world that I could cover a Prince song. I'm not a good enough player and absolutely not a good enough singer. Or Arthur Alexander, the 60s soul singer, like there's no way I could sing one of his songs and not sound like a complete jive ass. That's as much part of it. Do we love it, and can we do it both technically and, I guess, spiritually/socially?
Well, maybe we should talk about the technical side of things, because the people who listened to Jolene a few minutes ago might be wondering what exactly your band consists of. What have they actually heard from an instrumental point of view? Perhaps you could fill us in and even maybe share some of the Shoo Shoo philosophy.
There's three core players. David Kendrick lives in Los Angeles, plays percussion, and both he and I are involved in writing the lyrics for our original songs. And then Angela Hyun-hae-saw is mainly a keyboard player and synthesizer player and percussionist. She's also deeply involved in producing our records and does vocals also. And myself mostly play guitar and synthesizer and kind of, you know, experimental electronics and sing. And all of us are not play very well, but are interested in basically anything that makes an unusual sound. And we have a very, very, very large collection of since we started, I've been collecting percussion instruments, and we'll try to use those in hopefully unusual ways. I'm always asking me about the philosophy of the band is a very fair question, but I'm always a little bit hesitant to be too analytical about what we're trying to do, only because I'd rather just keep my head down and try to do it and not think about it so much. I'm just afraid of breaking, you know, the spell of any momentum we may have. But it's a good question. It's a fair question. I could give a broad strokes one.
Do that, yeah, because maybe philosophy was too kind of grand a word anyway. Maybe I'm just asking what you like to do.
Oh, I'm just a workaholic. I mean, I go to the studio 6 or 7 days a week, and we tour all the time. I just really love working on music. But our music tends to... The lyrics are... Actually, I guess that's another aspect of cover songs that are important to us, too, is are the lyrics saying something? As I mentioned, my dad was a musician, and when I was a teenager and I started thinking about music more, he sat me down and had a couple of serious conversations with me about the potential for music to be important. And he said, you know, think of what a song is about. So even though sometimes that can be difficult to put into words, sometimes it's, you know, very linear. It's about a particular narrative. It is about something. Any time we try to do something, it is always, I could tell you specifically what it is about. There's a purpose for doing it. And aesthetically, we have very wide interest in music and go down a lot of paths, but fundamentally, we want the listener to get something out of the song. And the most basic way to do it is to have the song have some very distinct meaning. Not that I don't, as a fan of music, like completely vacuous party songs that are, you know, techno songs that have two words in them and it's hard to say what they're about, other than just, you know, potentially being free on the dance floor. But for us, the reason that we're doing something is for the listener to get something out of it, and that hopefully that the meaning of the song imparts something individual to them.
You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford, and I'm speaking to Jamie Stewart from Shushu. All of what you said is very interesting, but I have to ask how this relates to the films of David Lynch, and particularly the music in the films of David Lynch, where there aren't lyrics.
Oh, as I know, I'm kind of contradicting myself a little bit, but let me try to expand on that. Instrumental music can be as meaningful when, before I was in Shushu, but I was a younger person starting to get serious about music. I worked in a record store like almost every other musician on earth. And the person who ran the classical department had a bit of a dark streak in him. And he knew that I was interested in darker music, and I didn't know very much about classical music, and I asked him, you know, bearing in mind our mutual interest, where do I start? And he gave me Shostakovich's, I always forget titles. It's either the Fifth Symphony, the Seventh, or the Eighth, but it's essentially about his World War II experience.
Okay, and the Seventh.
Seventh, thank you. And when knowing that ahead of time and reading the liner notes and having heard it from my work colleague, when you listen to it, it is palpably apparent that is what is happening, that he is expressing, I mean, particularly in, you know, in the Soviet era and his, you know, sort of being under the thumb of him personally and the entire society being under the thumb of Stalin, but then also dealing with World War II killed more people in the Soviet Union than any other country. His horror is so apparent when you listen to that. And it was, that record was incredibly important to me, and that it did kind of just what you mentioned. It shows that there is and can be incredibly direct and specific meaning in instrumental music at all of the time, even though, as I said, lyrics are incredibly important to me. So music in and of itself, sound in and of itself, can have very, very specific meaning. And I presume that you're alluding to our playing sort of a tribute to the aesthetics of Eraserhead, which is largely instrumental.
Yes.
But also
that you've done Twin Peaks, for
instance.
Oh,
yeah, so. And a lot of that music is instrumental also. I mean, both of those, I'll say Twin Peaks is a single piece rather than a, you know, I mean, it is a TV show, but Twin Peaks is a, even though it's a lot of episodes, is a single piece.
It is, yeah.
Both of those works, Eraserhead and Twin Peaks, exist in such very, very, very specific worlds, emotionally and especially texturally. You can identify something from Twin Peaks in seconds, even though the music goes a lot of places and is incredibly interesting. It has a sound like you could be in a band and say, oh, we sound like Twin Peaks. And, you know, it's like a genre almost. And similarly with Eraserhead, the sound design and the production is so specific. And because both of them are so specific, they have a very broad but very distinct emotionality. And that's a lot of what drew us to wanting to explore those. In addition to the fact that just as fans, the especially Twin Peaks, the approach of that work greatly, greatly shaped how we wanted to do music.
I also want to ask you about the way you use your voice, because sometimes you are, well, quite often actually, you're close mic'd, you're almost whispering into the microphone against a background of a sort of barrage of noise. And I wonder whether you think about this, I'm going to use the word philosophical again, from a philosophical point of view, and what your voice means in that context.
Making choices like that are really coming from a no brain perspective. When we're working on a record, I'll ask my bandmate Angela if it's not readily apparent to me what quote unquote voice this song seems to need, and I'll give her a couple, and she'll just go that one. But we don't talk about why it's that one. I think for us, it's the one that puts across the feeling of the song in the way that seems the most true. But why that is, I couldn't tell you in words.
No, and that's a good answer, I think. All right, we're going to listen to something from your last album of originals. It's called 13-inch Frank Beltrame Italian Stiletto with Bison Horn Grips, which is quite some title, but at least I can say it on national radio, unlike the current album. We're going to listen to Common Loon. What should we know about this track before we listen to it? And indeed, what should we know about the album? And about the stiletto, perhaps?
I have a lot of collections, and one of the collections I have is of switchblades. And although I'm a vegan, the 13-inch Frank Beltrame Italian stiletto with bison horn grips that I have actually has imitation bison horn grips, but it seemed like the title did not need yet another word. It's a fairly long story as to why we chose that as the title. But this song and this record largely is David, the drummer that we play with, is a massive fan of 60s and 70s psych rock, and I had never really listened to it, neither had Angela so much, and he's challenged us to try to make a psych rock record, especially I think as we were unfamiliar with the genre. So this is our attempt to explore that world.
Yeah, but that's what I said about it being a dare some of the time.
Oh.
So tell us about
fair, yes, in this case in particular.
Tell us about Common Loon.
It is to me, and I would not want to impose my own interpretation of the song on anybody else if they feel another way about it. We very much want it to be what it is for them. But for me, it is a song for people who believe themselves to be weirdos in one way or another, maybe particularly in a gender sense, and essentially going... The song is about being yourself. Being fearless about who you are physically, and that can be in a gender-based way or in a sexual way, but it could be about being yourself, in any kind of way whatsoever.
Or even carrying a 13-inch stiletto.
In an appropriate setting.
Of course, yes. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed, Jamie Stewart, for being my guest on The Music Show.
Oh, great to talk to you. Your questions were superb. Thank you very, very much. I really appreciate your time.
Common Loon by Shushu. That's from their album 13-inch Frank Beltrami Italian Stiletto with Bison Horn Grips. One of my favourite album titles ever, I think. If you're going to Dark Mofo in June, you'll be able to find Shushu there presenting their version of Eraserhead. And by the way, if you enjoyed their version of Jolene, or for that matter, if you didn't, we have much more of that coming your way soon. Cover Story is returning, and Jolene is going to be the first song in the new series with Adelaide Cabaret Festival's Reuben Kay and Gillian Cosgriff. That's in a few weeks' time. You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. In 1707, Alessandro Scarlatti composed an oratorio called Il Primo Omicidio, The First Murder. It features Cain and Abel and their parents, Adam and Eve, and naturally God and Satan. There's also some sung commentary from them. They're a kind of chorus. Now, just few hundred years later, it's having a performance by Pinchgut Opera in Sydney and in a distinctly Australian setting, as you will hear. We have Aaron Helliard welcoming him back to the music show. He's the AD of Pinchgut, along with two mezzo-sopranos who sing the roles of Cain and Abel. They're going to give us a preview. We'll talk about the thing and they'll sing something for us. But let's start with a recording. This is the start of the oratorio, the introduction from the recording by Academie für Alte Musik Berlin. René Jacobs is conducting. That's the introduction to Scarlatti's oratorio, The First Murder, Il Primo Omicidio, directed by René Jacobs in that recording. And It's a pleasure to welcome back to the music show the artistic director of Pinchgut Opera. That's Aaron Helliard, and he's brought with him two of the stars of the forthcoming production, Ashley Timms and Madison Lenoir. Welcome, all of you. Aaron, can I start with you? Can I get you perhaps to tell us the story of this of this oratorio come opera, and, you know, a spoiler alert for anybody who's never read the Book of Genesis.
Exactly, Andy. Yes, it's an extraordinary piece. On the title page, it says Sacred Entertainment, so we're not sure if it was staged or not. But it concerns the story of the first family. Adam and Eve have just been expelled from Eden for eating the tree of good and evil. And they've had two children, Cain and Abel, and they're living with the consequences of that decision. And out of this fractured family becomes the story of the first murder, but it also becomes the story of a family that becomes human, as it were, because Cain, of course, goes on to found the first human city. And it's a very mythic story. It's found in the Bible and the Quran. And Alessandro Scarlatti was asked to set it by one of his colleagues, Otto Boni, who worked with Handel. And it's an extraordinary elemental score that I've wanted to do for many years.
And perhaps we should just clarify Alessandro Scarlatti. This is not the famous composer of all of those hundreds of keyboard sonatas. That was his son.
That's correct. Yeah, he had a large family, just like J.S. Bach. And his son went on to compose a bajillion harpsichord sonatas. But Alessandro Scarlatti himself is a very important figure in Italian opera. And I've always wanted to explore his work. And this is really one of his great masterpieces from a really interesting point in his compositional career, when he was experimenting with great psychological depth and really extraordinary musical craftsmanship.
And it had its premiere in 1707. There's some significance in the historical moment?
It was when Scarlatti had a bit of a dip in his career, and he was having issues with Roman musical life and was trying to revive his musical fortunes in Venice. And he had mixed successes. We don't quite know what the reception of the first murder was, but it does come from this period of life when he was writing quite a lot and in a new style that's extremely tender and poignant and spare, but extremely heartfelt.
And you say you're not sure whether it was performed, whether it was staged or not, whether it was an oratorio or an opera.
That's right. So in Rome at the time, there were various edicts against public opera, and music-loving cardinals kind of got around that. They had a bit of renegade opera, so they would commission sacred works that would be lightly staged. And we have lots of evidence of this. In fact, Handel's Resurrezione, which has the words by Otto Boni, we know was staged. And so it's very likely that this could have also found a very light staging in a private house or private chapel. But certainly at Pinchgut, we always are looking for works from the Baroque that have contemporary relevance. And I think this story is brought to life by Ashlyn and Maddie, just absolutely extraordinary and really worthwhile bringing to the Australian stage.
Yeah, well, I mean, contemporary relevance, I mean, just the title, The First Murder, it sounds like a Netflix series, doesn't it?
It should be.
Maybe I could bring in Ashlyn and Madison, who are Cain and Abel, mezzos. Ashlyn, can you perhaps describe how this works? Because you're being doubled by male actors, aren't you, in this production? Does that make things easier for you or harder?
It makes things very creative and exploratory. And yeah, it's been an interesting few weeks of rehearsal, working with two young men as Cain and Abel and myself and Maddie. And we're finding some really interesting aspects that I guess you wouldn't have if it was just the traditional sense of what we're used to with traditional opera, singing and acting that role on your own. Now there is, in fact, two to each character, and one is expressing movement while we express a voice, but there is definitely an interplay between the two of us at all times. And I think what we're finding is really interesting, and I think for audience will show maybe more facets of each character that maybe we couldn't do if we were doing it solely.
Right, no. But I'm assuming the actors aren't lip syncing.
No, they are not. They come from musical theatre and dancing backgrounds. So they are moving and acting.
So it's actually more like ballet in a way, that they are moving to the music.
Yes, and at times they are still and acting these roles of these two young men. And I think, you know, they're rising to the challenge as well as us. And it's something new for myself personally. And I think... And new for them also. So we're all learning and exploring in this very exciting project.
Yeah. Maddie, Erin was saying we're not sure whether this was staged or not. If it was staged in 1707, chances are it wasn't set on an Australian beach.
Yeah.
tell us about the staging that you're involved in.
Yeah, so we're setting the show and really talking about nostalgia and looking back at sort of, I guess it's like the 1970s period of, just a typical family beach holiday, really, and all the memories associated with looking back on your childhood and trying to understand things that happened through the lens maybe of adults. And I think that's where Ash and I kind of have found our characters, is that we are sort of the adults looking back at what had happened on this particular holiday. It's very elemental and it's very interesting and symbolic, and I think there'll be some really cool imagery and surprises in there for everyone.
Well, it sounds like it, because when you say a typical family beach holiday, it's not really typical, is it?
No.
Most of them don't end in murder.
No, that's true, thankfully.
Erin, what about the instrumentation? Because with Baroque operas, oratorios, we don't always know exactly what was used, what the composer had in mind. You know, sometimes we rely on receipts for payment, or we rely on paintings to see what was being played. What do we know about what Scarlatti wanted, and what are you doing with this information?
That's a great question, Andy. Yeah, we know that Ottoboni, who was the librettist, had a very large orchestra of which Corelli was the head. We're not sure if he came from Rome to Venice to perform in this piece. But what was clear was Ottoboni loved having a very rich orchestra that was at his private home, which is extraordinary. But Scarlatti's score shows a score for strings and continuo instrument. He only specifies the harpsichord, but we know from, exactly as you say, receipts from orchestras and pitches, particularly in Rome, that they enjoyed a very rich continuo instrument collection. And the continuo instrument, of course, are the harmonic instruments that accompany the strings. And Scarlatti has very helpfully given us figures to show the harmonies that we play. And the continuo group that I've put together for this production is very rich indeed and does reflect that Roman tradition. And we have a harp, we have a theorbo, a guitar, an organ, a harpsichord, and a very special instrument to paint the character of Lucifer, because, of course, God and Lucifer are in this story as well. And Lucifer was spirits and demons in the 17th century were traditionally accompanied by an instrument called the regale, which is a reed organ that's very snarly and farty. And, of course, the first time it was used was in Monteverdi's Orfeo to paint the character of the underworld, Caronte, and in the 17th century, it was always associated with things evil and sinister. So I've used it to paint the character of Lucifer. So when you come to the Rospacca, you'll certainly be in for a surprise when our wonderful Taran Phoebic scholar, Freddie Shaw, opens his mouth and he will be accompanied by my farting regale.
No one's ever said that on the music show before. Well done.
It's a wonderful snarling sound. I actually love it. It's very sort of tart, but it does sound a little bit farty.
Good. Maybe we could widen this conversation a little bit. Ashlyn, you do lots of contemporary opera, and there has been a tradition in the last, about the last 50 years, actually, of singers who sing lots of Baroque music and lots of contemporary music and nothing much in between. Do you find that there are correspondences between what you're asked to do vocally in Baroque music and what you do in contemporary music?
Yeah, I mean, I was just having a think while you were asking that, because yes, I think there is for me, I feel with Baroque and with modern music, there is an essence of like you could be more authentic with what you're doing as an artist. So you can make a lot more choices, I find, especially when I've been involved with modern operas that are for the first time. The premiere of those works. I love the liberty that I can take with the characters, being the first person to have sung those roles. I can make all the choices I want. It's kind of like a painter being able to use whatever color you want. And I feel like Baroque music allows me to do a similar thing with my voice and with how I act these roles. There's not so much of a traditional sense of how these roles should be sung, and that gives me a lot of freedom, which I absolutely adore to have, rather than sometimes, you know, in the traditional grand opera where there is just so many versions of these characters that sometimes you feel like you're having to formulate your rendition against these many great artists that can be compared to. So yes, I love the freedom of these genres, and using my voice in as many ways as possible, it's very fun for me.
And I suppose even musically that there is a sense of experimentation or exploration when you do a work like this. I mean, because, you know, as Aaron was saying, I mean, we're not even sure what instruments are used. So you're kind of, it's almost like you've got the manuscript from the composer and now you're trying to work out what's what.
Yes, and I think with this particular work, there's many recitatives and many parts of the score with the text, and that we can ornament in different ways, meaning we can make up notes that we can put in almost like we're composing on the spot. And Aaron is very brilliant at this in helping us find some ideas, and then as singers we take the emotion behind this text and then we embellish it further. So this is a very unique aspect to this Baroque music, and you know, it's definitely not something that we do in later opera. We can do that in this style.
This is your Pinchgut debut, both of you, Aisling and Maddie. But Maddie, you worked with Ensemble Pygmalion, and we talked earlier this year with Raphael Pichon. Maybe you could say something about this. We were terribly impressed.
About Pygmalion?
Yeah.
I mean, they are wonderful, and Raphael is such a force of nature. I did a really, really sparky kind of inspired Orfeu with them in Bordeaux, and I mean they're very similar in terms of there's such passion in their outfit and their group for Baroque music, and that's something that I have just loved so much about Pinchgut. And I was saying to everybody in my life for many years that it was a huge dream of mine to work here with Aaron and with his company, so this is a dream come true for me. But I just wanted to add on to what Ash just said about the sort of the conventions of Baroque. These roles that we're singing were obviously written for castrati originally, and it was a huge thing at the time for the castrati to be very inventive with their ornamentation. Audiences were not only coming for the beautiful music and to be seen at the concert, you know, they were also coming for these castrati and to hear what kind of brilliant ornamentation they made up on the spot. And I mean, that was the whole thing. It was completely improvised back then. And I will get there one day, being able to improvise on the spot. But that's the exciting part of it as a Baroque performer, is there is, as Ash was saying, there's such freedom and such liberty. But, you know, it's a living art form, and that's one of the great joys of performing in the Baroque space, is you are really allowed to be an artist in a way that, yes, you are also allowed to be an artist in other operas, but I don't know, my bias tells me that you're allowed to be even more of an artist in Baroque.
I have to say, Maddie is too humble. She's a brilliant ornamenter, and Aisling as well. It's really wonderful to work with performer composers. It's great.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I hope we're going to hear some of that, because you haven't just come in to talk, you have come in to sing for us as well. So, Aaron, which bit are you going to do? Could you set this up for us?
Well, the piece we're about to hear, Andy, is just the A section of this remarkable duet at the end of part one. So if you want to hear the ornaments and the full beauty of the virtuosity of our singers, you'll have to come to the Roz Packer. But this first section, we've just come to the point in the oratorio where Cain has decided to kill Abel. But before he does so, he decides to sing a loving duet of affection. And they sing here of their tender love for each other. In the B section, Cain breaks the fourth wall and tells us how much he's desiring a vengeance. And then in probably the earliest example of a da capo in which this happens in musical history that I know of, we hear the text again, but the audience knows that Cain doesn't mean what he says.
Oh, that's very clever. Wow. Well, we'll have to imagine that bit or pay for our ticket to come and hear it.
Exactly. It's one of just the few structural moments of genius that Scarlatti has in the score.
There. Great. Okay. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming into the Music Show studio. We're going to hear now Ashlyn Timms as Cain and Madison Lenoir as Abel, and playing the harpsichord, Aaron Hellyard. Ashlyn Timms and Madison Lenoir with Aaron Hellyard. The first murder is at Roslyn Packer Theatre in Sydney from the 23rd to the 31st of May. The details are on the Music Show's website. And the Music Show is going to be at the Sydney Writers Festival on the 21st of May. We will have on stage Ziggy Ramo, Leah Senior and Kate Fagan. The details of that are on our website too. If you're not around, you'll be able to hear it in due course on ABC Radio National. Next time on the show, after I think more than a quarter of a century, we welcome back Judy Small.
There must be a million stories in that weather-beaten face, but in all the years I've watched her, I've never heard her voice slipping in between the cars, but never in the way. She sells the daily papers on the corner at White Bay. Her shoes are built for comfort as she marches up and down, a little wizened figure, scarcely more than skin and bone. She sells the daily papers on the corner at White Bay, and the pennies that she makes will help to fill the pension void for
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.